Good morning. I'll call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. We are posted for possible measure introduction and an informational meeting. We're going to begin on the informational meeting unless we have five members. Maybe we will, in which case we will open a work session to introduce LC 248 as a committee bill. It will not be referred to this committee, given that it relates to elections. I'd be very surprised if it was and I think we're past our deadline for moving bills. But good morning, Representative Jensen.
Just one more out there. So
we only have... That would be fine. Okay, so as Representative Moon and Representative Jensen get settled, I will take a motion on introducing a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, I move...
Do I need a work session?
Yes.
Okay. I will open a work session for the purpose of measure introduction.
Mr. Chair, I move LC number 248 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Smith moves LC number 248 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion on the motion? I will point out that voting yes does not signify your support for this bill, nor is it the expectation of the committee that this bill would be referred to the committee. In fact, it's our expectation and sincere desire that it is not referred to the committee. Any discussion? It's a vessel, a basically empty vessel for
empty.
Something related to election.
Shall be.
Yes.
Can I fill in my own life?
Yeah, wait.
Wow.
No, you may not. Representative Jensen? Sometimes an means you'd like to speak.
Well, I recognize that, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not so reluctant to introduce it, nor am I so reluctant to necessarily have it come before this committee, but it just looks to me like all I'm doing is manufacturing more work for myself in another committee.
You are. Indeed, that is the case. As a member of the Rules Committee, going to see this again.
Can you tell us the impetus for it?
My understanding is that this is a bill that could be used to write ballot titles, and that's how it looks now. HJR 101, which is referenced in, is a resolution introduced by Representative Harker that relates to bonding authority for our higher ed system. This would be an accompanying, at least as it's drafted now, would be an accompanying LC that could be the ballot title for that.
The final question is, why this committee?
I think the Speaker's office was looking merely for a committee that's meeting this morning to introduce it.
Okay.
I think it has absolutely nothing to do with environment and water. We're pawns in a larger game about which we know little.
Hi.
Okay, well, all my questions have been answered.
Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, LC 248 is introduced as a committee bill. I will close the work session. We get that paperwork going. And open an informational meeting on... we'll start with that. We have a couple of topics. We have 55 minutes. So, Brenda and Phil, let's begin with the water resources strategy. Members will recall that this is an initiative that is the result of the fine work of this committee and Representative Jensen and Representative Smith in particular on House Bill 3369, and we're very interested to know where the department is in the process of developing this integrated statewide water resources strategy. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Phil Ward of the Water Resources Department. I'm here to support Brenda Bateman this morning. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to her, and I'll just kick in as we go along.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and this morning we're here to provide a brief update on the Integrated Water Resources Strategy that we've been working on for the past year now. In front of you, you should have a draft copy of our preliminary work plan, so that will have a lot of the detail that we'll be covering in this morning's presentation. At its heart, the The Oregon's Integrated Water Resource Strategy is designed to help us better understand and to meet Oregon's water resource needs. Sounds simple enough, but that's the fundamental goal. And when we're talking about meeting those needs, we're talking about both in-stream and out-of-stream needs. We're talking about water quality, water quantity, and ecosystem needs altogether, which is what makes this an integrated approach. And we're talking about both today and in the future. And so this is very simply what we're trying to achieve that's up here on the screen in front of you. We'll be getting into a little bit more detail about goals and objectives in subsequent slides.
And as you did mention, Mr. Chair, this effort was authorized specifically in House Bill 3369 from last legislative session.
The formal beginning to this plan does come from House Bill 3369, the 2009 session. Of course, the agencies have been laying a foundation of data and other technical pieces before that even came about. But in House Bill 3369, specifically sections 44 through 45, you'll see mention of the strategy. And in that, it directs the Water Resources Department to lead efforts to produce a strategy. But of course, if we're talking about water quality along with water quantity and ecosystem needs, need to partner with our sister agencies. And so specifically in the bill, that calls out DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, and Department of Agriculture as the primary agencies involved in this effort. And then, of course, it instructs us to collaborate and work with other agencies and tribes, stakeholders, and the public as part of this effort as well. House Bill 3369 sets forth the goals from the previous slide, that is, better understanding and meeting Oregon's water resource needs, and then it specifically asks us to account for coming changes, and it lists several, including population growth and land use change, but particularly calls out climate change and asks us to look into that in a bit more detail in terms of monitoring and adapting, anticipating the changes that are to come there. The timeline for this strategy is that in 2011 we are to make a report to the legislature on our benchmarks and progress thus far, and then the Water Resource Commission is the ultimate adopter of the strategy. It takes effect upon adoption by the commission, but before that happens, this commission will need to notify the other boards and commissions of the agencies that we mentioned previously. The commission plans to send the first rendition of this plan to the legislature in 2012, and House Bill 3369 and then asks for updates in 5-year increments thereafter. So this is a bit more detail about the goals and objectives. We've taken the requirements that are listed in House Bill 3369 and reordered them a bit, put them in this format so that we have a bit more of a roadmap for the things that we need to be addressing as we move forward through this effort. And so you'll see here two fundamental goals, that is improving our understanding of Oregon's water resources, and then goal number two, actually meeting those water resource needs. And then underneath each of those, you have objectives that break down in a little bit more detail what we need to be looking at as part of this project. In-stream and out-of-stream needs, a look at the water resource itself, that would be surface water, groundwater, and the interaction between them, and then the pressures that we may be seeing in the future that affect both of those things.
And if committee members have any questions as we go, we'll interrupt you to ask them.
Okay. One thing that we wanted to note was under each of these seven objectives, the work of many of the advisory groups that we'll be talking about today and the stakeholders and the public as they provide input to us, we are actually aiming for recommended actions underneath each of these objectives. Oftentimes when you open up a state plan of this type, you'll see a dozen or so of the fundamental recommended actions that have come out of this effort. And so that is the goal for this project, underneath each objective, to have a recommended action or two. And that's where the policy advisory group and other advisory groups will be spending their time developing those recommended actions over the next several months. Specifically, to help us organize our work and our thoughts and the final product, we have a framework that we've put together in six different areas: information and data, planning, policy, statute and rule, funding, and then education and outreach.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the previous slide, I just want to flag something. You don't need to comment, maybe we can, but under meeting Oregon's water resource needs, I see objective 4 and 5 above, sort of about future pressures, and I would at least put a plug for, you know, the meeting of water resource needs, including sort of, I don't know if that's objective 8 or restating objective 4 and 5 about sort of future water needs, which is a significant interest of some.
Very good.
As we went about formulating this framework, we did this and chose these areas because we think this will help us ask the right questions as we are delving more deeply into the objectives in the previous slide. So I'll flip back to the previous slide and take as an example objective number 1. As we're looking at in-stream needs, the kinds of questions that we need to be asking ourselves are, out of this framework, what kind of information and data do we use in order to better understand needs? What sort of plans are in place today? And so we're looking at plans that exist throughout the state, land use plans, forestry plans, Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds, those kinds of plans. Where do they address or not address each of these objectives? What kind of policies do we have in place that speak to each of these objectives? And moving on down through the framework, asking ourselves questions in each of these areas. We believe that setting up the conversation this way, asking ourselves these particular questions in this order, helps us keep our eye on the integrated nature of the strategy so that we can constantly be revisiting each of the objectives and covering them thoroughly as we move through the project. I wanted to spend just a few minutes talking about the institutional capacities that we've built up during phase one of our project, which took place during year 2009. First, we formulated our project team, and so this is senior staff from the 4 agencies that are called out in the original bill. As you can see here on the screen, I'm the project manager for the team, and then we also have staff members from DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, Department of Agriculture, and we have a policy and technical advisor that are part of our team as well, and a policy intern who is helping us search out additional grant monies as part of this project. We've also put together an agency advisory group, and so this is comprised of 15 natural resource and economic development agencies at the state level. And their work here is on the technical side. They have already helped provide material for the issue papers, the background papers that we put together. And they will continue to provide input to the policy advisory group as they meet and other groups as they do their work.
So just a note there, Mr. Chair, if I may, we've experienced great support from the other state natural resource and economic development agencies in this effort. As you all know, as Representative Jensen knows specifically, there were limited resources provided for this effort. And so the commitments from the majority of the agencies here that you're seeing, they're just finding a way to participate because they believe this is an important effort, and we very much have felt supported by the other state agencies in this effort.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil and Brenda, have you looked outside of state agencies for advisory group? Specifically, have you looked into the private sector when we're talking about, and one of the things I was anxiously waiting before asking any questions was where the role of economic development or growth in Oregon might, you know, fit into the advisor or into the plans that the department would have for a water resource strategy. And I very much appreciate, you know, the advisory group you have there, but I'm curious about whether you looked outside and considered outside of the state agencies for advisory groups.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think there's a good story to tell there, and as we work on through this presentation, I think that'll become evident to you.
That's fine. Thank you.
In fact, the next slide is about the Policy Advisory Group, and this is a group of 18 citizen members from around the state. It does include private sector representation, and actually is very diverse in terms of the perspectives the members hold, whether they're water users, environmental advocates, conservation groups. These 18 folks are from all throughout the state and met for the first time here in Salem on January 19th. They've put together a charter for their own group, and we're also drafting a vision of their own for the strategy in terms of what a picture of water resource, the physical water, might look like 50 years out, the kinds of things that they wanted to see as part of this project. And their main role here will be advisory, but will be helping us to identify and to prioritize the recommended actions that I talked about earlier that will come underneath each of those objectives. Of course, as part of this process, you can imagine that we'll come up with quite a laundry list of potential recommended actions. So this group's role will really be to help us pare down in a practical way what the recommended actions will look like by the end. They're planning to meet on a quarterly basis. Their next meeting is on April 14th, and their meetings will take in turn each of those framework items that we talked about before and take that as a theme of the meeting. So their next meeting in April will specifically focus on information and data, and we'll talk about each of those objectives. What kind of information do we need in Oregon when we're making decisions about each of these objectives?
The roster of that group is on pages 7 and 8 of the draft plan that we have at the dais, at least at all members.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The next advisory group that we've put together is more on the technical and scientific side. This particular advisory group has a very specific role to play and is helping the departments look at the idea of peak and ecological flow. That phrase may strike a chord with you. You may recall that also from House Bill 3369, in which the departments are asked to protect peak and ecological flow as part of a grant and loan program, and to do that and have that in place by the year 2012. So this advisory group is made up of, is chaired by Water Resources Department's George Robeson, and is made up of 9 credentialed scientists in this area. And they come from local, state, and federal agencies, as well as the private sector, and are pulled in specifically to look at the science of this, what's currently in play in other states, what does the literature say, trying to help us get definitions down on paper and understand the methodologies that are out there and available for understanding and protecting peak and ecological flows.
And Mr. Chair, as Representative Jensen has suggested, we have asked the IMST to serve as the peer review body, the formal peer review body for this effort, and we believe they've agreed.
Anywhere else?
The other piece that was put into place as part of phase one in 2009 of this project was a series of issue papers or background papers. And this became a very important piece for us as we were starting to talk to folks about planning. We did get a lot of questions about why Oregon needs to plan, because we're a wet state and we have no water problems. Well, it occurred to us that we should probably pause in our process to put together a series of background papers that lays out just exactly what the status is of water resources in our state, because of course it differs greatly depending on whether you're on the east side or west side, what your water source is, what you're using water for, and time of year especially. So these papers were put together with help from water resource commissioners and also agency staff and partners and experts in each of these areas. And they really serve as a straw man for us. And the first round, we put together very simple papers, a few pages each, in the areas that you see before you on the screen: water quantity, water quality, economic developments, ecosystems and ecology, social, cultural aspects, and also specifically focused on climate change because of the requirements of the bill. And we took public comments during the fall 2009, got quite a few comments, most of them very supportive, actually. I'll show that on the next page. Heard from more than 30 different organizations and individuals who had very positive and supportive things to say about the overall process. Most of the comments were focused on additions. You know, please cite this study or please mention this project as an example. And a couple of comments, of course, were in direct opposition to each other. And so we continue to sift through those comments and figure out just exactly where we want these papers to go. We're working on the second rendition right now and hope to have that out and available for public review mid-year this year, but I can tell you that a lot of the baseline data, statistics, and information that are in here are going to land directly in the strategy in its final form, and provide a lot of the background that you'll see in that document when it comes out in 2012. So where are we now? We're in phase two of the project. As I say, we've developed a lot of the institutional capacity, put a lot of the background information down and had it documented, and so now we're moving into more of an information collection and vetting phase, and you're going to start to hear a lot more about the public meetings that we're having and the workshops that we're conducting with different stakeholder groups and associations. So, for instance, one of the venues that we'll be using in our information gathering and vetting will be open houses, and these are going to serve three purposes for us. One is to make sure that we've provided information to the public about the strategy, what it is, and what it will probably look like, and then we're also seeking input from the public about what folks would like to see, where they would really like us to focus our efforts and investments in water resource programs over the next several years. And finally, we wanted to use this to showcase local successes. You know, we have communities who have already been at work in this area for quite some time and have some great successes to show. So we wanted to make sure that we had highlighted those and provided some examples even for other communities to look at, maybe take up as a model or a pattern for how they may conduct some of their projects and approaches in the future. Again, on these open houses, we're enjoying quite a bit of support from folks. The agencies that have been involved in the project at the core level will be sending many of their field staff to be at these events and answer any technical questions that may crop up. The economic revitalization team from the governor's office has been looking at these with great interest, and I think some of their staff will be able to make it to these events. We also have local facilitators from each community who are providing their services pro bono for these open houses. We want to make sure that we have conversations that are comparable between communities and that they are well facilitated and well organized and consistent. And so we have a group of folks who have agreed to help us with that piece. And then we also have great sponsors and partners from both the public and private sector who will be helping out with these events. More on the open houses. These are the communities that we're planning to visit. Starting March 31st will be the first open house, and then we'll go all the way through the spring and into June. And so we'll have 10 communities that we'll be visiting as part of this project and in this round. The second venue that we'll be using as part of phase two to gather and vet information are workshops. So these are a little bit more specific conversations with associations and stakeholder groups that you know many of whom you're familiar with here in the building. And we've been visiting with their members and their board members and their water policy committees over the last several weeks and months, and we'll continue to do that throughout this project so that we can make sure that we're hearing from water experts and water practitioners in each community as we're moving through and collecting ideas. So you'll continue to hear about those, and I believe there's a list of previous and upcoming meetings that's at the back of your work plan packet as well. And with that, unless you have something to add,
I just have one thing to add with your permission, Mr. Chair. Many states have undertaken this effort, and most, when they've undertaken it, have undertaken it in the classic water supply plan model. So what you have directed us to do is a bit unique in that you've directed us to truly integrate water quality and water quantity and ecosystem services, the ecological needs that obviously are a very important part of the equation. What we hope to do then is not produce, because frankly we don't have the funding to do it, the classic multiple page phone book style plan, where in Texas they took 7 years and tens of millions of dollars to do it. Actually that was $7 million and ten, I can't remember, I've got that backwards, but anyway it was a lot more money than we're spending. What we hope to do is actually have an action agenda for your consideration at the end of this process. So much more outcome-oriented, where we develop something that clearly identifies, again, for the legislature's
consideration, ultimately, actions that can be taken to address and meet Oregon's water resource needs in the years ahead. So that's kind of our path, Mr. Chair and members, and again, we'd be happy to respond to any questions if you have.
Thanks, Phil. We have about 5 minutes for further discussion.
Well, I just want to thank you for what you've done. It's always good to see what happens when we pass a bill, and I was on this bill, and I'm very much impressed with the breadth and depth of the work that you've done so far. And I see that you have an open house scheduled for my district, which I'll be happy to go to if I'm still alive.
Thank you very much. Representative Denson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of items, then a little bit of an update on 3369 that perhaps they'll want to add more to after I make a comment. One of the things, though, before I get to 3369 that I am still concerned with, and I think that there is language in 3369 to make these things maybe a little more inclusive than I've seen in your presentation, and that has to do with the other needs, and I mentioned one, the economic need, and I would include also the social cultural needs that appear as far as water is concerned. I recognize that part of the cultural thing will be in some ways addressed via the ecological works that you're doing, the fishing end of it, and both in terms of commercial fishing and in terms of recreational fishing. But there are, many other things in there, and I would be remiss if I didn't remind you, even though I'm sure you're on the same page that I am, but that those things probably need to be taken into consideration in the reports that you're putting together and the agenda you're putting together for things. A little bit of update on the Umatilla Basin project as I understand it, things are in good shape right now, in great shape right now, and that I don't know whether you've released money from the agency yet to the consortium or what was the consortium, but one of the things that slowed that down a little bit was the need of creation of a legal entity that had to be in place for the money to go before the department was able to move forward with that. That legal entity, to my knowledge, has been formally created at this point, and I believe everything is on the fast track, at least as far as moving ahead with that project. And for those of you who forget, there was a sum of $5 million, I think, that was basically dedicated to do some additional work there in the efforts to restore water in some of the aquifers and also to provide some, in-stream benefits, and to be able to document, some of those benefits that were present. The basin project itself still has probably another $40 or $50 million, to come up with before they reach before they achieve the goals that they initially had in mind. The steps that we've taken are preliminary to that, just simply for the purpose of ensuring that this is going to both be a sound economic and environmental project. So I don't know whether you have any other comments on that or not, but I think somewhere along the line it is important for this committee, who has dealt very deeply you know, with that project, and a couple of us spent more time probably than we're accustomed to spending on one little bill that in terms of the whole scheme of Oregon legislation was a little bill, but that we think might be a huge step. I think one of the for me, one of the successes that was demonstrated with this is the creation of this new legal entity that as other areas around the state, when we start looking at water development, water restoration, water conservation, et cetera, type of thing, that are, they're going to probably have to follow, or probably need to follow, maybe they don't have to, but need to follow a somewhat similar pattern there, where they have a very broad base of support then, ranging from the environmental community to the farmers to et cetera. For that, I think all of us who had any part in this can be very happy that they have put that together, and it's gone from a coalition to more formalized setting now, and it looks very promising. We appreciate the department's work. The department has been very helpful with this.
Thanks, Representative Jensen, and appreciate the update on the Umatilla project. We'll note for the committee, my notes, Representative Jensen said a few words about our progress on the recharge. True. We should have a more in-depth discussion of it, yeah, and possibly even before we adjourn in February. So thanks. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you very much. I know that this was set, we set this forth, the legislature set this forth in a year of a challenging budget, including the Water Resources Department budget being ever challenged, and think that the planning process is still something we need to do, even in challenging times. In fact, one could argue that at a challenging time, it might be the most important time to set forth a real plan. A couple thoughts. The first is, as we're moving forward, as you make the decision saying, okay, well, we can't afford seven volumes, we can afford something else, right? Something that would be very valuable would be the combination of questions that haven't yet been answered, okay, stuff that hadn't yet been done, and, sort of a plan to make a plan, right? Does that mean we keep doing this? Does that mean we ask for appropriation in the future? What does that look like? How do we answer the unanswered question? That would be my first comment. The second, among those, I think we need to come to grips with maximizing economic use. And again, I think too often we falsely think of this as a binary set of considerations, which it really is not. And come to grips with, is our maximal economic use going to be shooting potatoes through a water knife? Is it going to be growing those potatoes? Is it going to be growing livestock feed? Is it going to be moving turbines? And I don't expect that in the next blank number of months we're going to answer all those questions in this plan, but it is among the most important set of questions we've got to answer. And starting to come to grips with that, I think, would be valuable. And giving us guidance about what we need to do in the future to answer that question, I think, would also be helpful. Because if we can start getting on the same side of the table approaching a common problem, how can we best use our water, our water resource to maximize economic benefit as well as other benefits? I think that would be valuable, and I know we're running short of time, so I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you, Representative Smith. I appreciate the committee's attention to this, and your work, Brenda and Phil, very much is really impressive, and I would draw the committee's attention to that, again, to that work plan that we have in front of us. In the back is an appendix that includes their current meeting calendar for the rest of the year, and you'll see the dozens of meetings that they have scheduled around the state, not only the ones that the open houses that they showed us, but the reaching out that they're doing to stakeholder groups, to other agencies, and I think it's a really valuable and important effort. So appreciate your hard work on it. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Representative Jensen.
Could I just make one additional comment? And I put my environmental hat on too, and I know some of you will find that to be something of a joke, but in the name of protection of the environment, Would it be possible, as you deliver this material that you have to us, to do it electronically instead of via the paper route? And I believe we've provided every legislative office in the Capitol with computers that can handle that electronically. And I think even staff has that sort of technology available. So could I use this as a request? And even if you can't get to all of them, could you get at least get mine to me electronically?
Well, let's set the default at electronic, and you'll hear from members if they prefer otherwise.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. And with that, I'm not actually going to close an informational session. We'll just carry on an informational session, changing topics to the low-carbon fuel standard, another one of the big initiatives that we, this committee and this legislature, adopted last session. And Andy Ginsberg and Dick Peterson, welcome back. We've seen very little of you this, for which I'm sure some members of the committee are grateful. But I enjoy seeing you. Welcome.
Yeah. So, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Department of Environmental Quality, and thank you for inviting us here today to explain to you what we're doing in terms of your tasks that you gave us to look at a low-carbon fuel standard and how that might be implemented in the state. And we're very glad you're glad to hear from Andy, because I'm going to turn it over to him. Andy.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator, DEQ. And as Dick mentioned, we're here to give an update on the low carbon fuel standard, which was an element of House Bill 2186. As you will recall, the goal of the low carbon fuel standard is to reduce greenhouse gas, life cycle greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels by 10% by the year 2020. It's different from the renewable fuel standard, which mandates certain percentages of biofuels to be blended. The low carbon fuel standard is a performance standard, calling for the 10% reduction and leaving it up to the fuel distributors how to achieve that. That said, it does dovetail nicely with the renewable fuel standard, and it's possible to make progress towards the low carbon fuel standard by complying with the renewable fuel standard. Other states are also moving forward with the low carbon fuel standard. California, of course, has already adopted and has begun implementing the standard. Washington is working under an executive order to evaluate a low carbon fuel standard, and they're scheduled to make a recommendation to their governor in the fall. And the Northeast states have signed a compact where they are moving forward together to look at a low-carbon fuel standard and considering not only transportation fuels but also possibly heating fuels in their program. House Bill 2186 set up a number of important protections thoroughly evaluating as we're considering this rulemaking. The first is looking at fuel supply to ensure that there's no disruptions of available transportation fuels, and fuel price to make sure that our fuel prices stay competitive with surrounding states. There's also protections for fuel quality to make sure that the fuel doesn't harm engines or results in off-spec fuels. Requires us to evaluate the safety issues, feasibility of compliance, cost effectiveness, and ensure that there's a net benefit in terms of not only greenhouse gases but also air pollution and water pollution and other considerations. The bill requires us to consider flexible compliance options and specifically exempts farm and log vehicles. In addition, the bill provides for significant legislative oversight and continuing involvement. First, the rules may not become effective until after the 2011 legislative session, so in July 2011. The authority for the Low Carbon Fuel Standard also sunsets on December 31st, 2015, so the program would have to be reauthorized to continue on to 2020, and requires us to make regular reports to the legislature and to the interim committees. Right now, we're primarily focused on our advisory committee. One of the commitments that Dick made is that for this bill and for all of our work, we're going to have extensive involvement of the public in our rulemaking, and this is no exception. We have a 29-member advisory committee chaired by Mark Reeve, who is a former Environmental Quality Commission member and who has chaired several committees for the department before. Members include fuel suppliers such as petroleum suppliers and fuel distributors, but also suppliers of low-carbon fuels, including electricity, natural gas, biofuels, ethanol, and hydrogen. And then we also have fuel users represented on the committee: truckers, auto association, the Farm Bureau, barges, rail, general contractors, and then a number of other stakeholders, including public interest, environmental, academic, local government, and some general public members as well. We've had, right now, as I said, we're very focused on the committee. We've had three successful meetings so far, and considering the size and diversity of that group, just having three successful meetings is a good start. We have seven additional meetings planned for the committee over the coming months. And the topics they've been considering are all the policy issues and technical issues we'll need to vet before we can design a rule. So, for example, what fuels are covered, what are the exemptions, how do we conduct the life cycle analysis, how do we set the low-carbon fuel baseline standard for Oregon's transportation fuels, the compliance schedule, the deferrals, how will they work, the consumer cost safety net, how will that work, compliance scenarios and economic analysis, reporting and compliance demonstrations, et cetera, all the many details that we need to develop this rule. As far as our schedule goes, as I said, we've already had three meetings, and through May we'll have a number of additional meetings where the committee will discuss these policy and technical issues. Then in June, the committee is going to be meeting with, I forgot to mention that we were fortunate to get a grant from EPA to work on this rulemaking, which we're using to hire a contractor to help us with the economic analysis. So that was a major major assistance that the EPA has provided us. And so in June, the committee will be meeting with the contractor to discuss the inputs for the economic modeling. And then during July and August, the committee will take a break while the contractor does the economic analysis. And in September, the contractor will then present the economic analysis to the committee. And then from November through December, the committee will wrap up their report, and we will prepare draft rules for the low-carbon fuel standard. However, we're not going to be putting the rules out on public notice. These are the actual rules that we would be considering, but we're going to wait until we've gotten some more input from the legislature during the 2011 session to actually move the rulemaking process forward. In October, we have another report to the interim committees, and then we're planning on holding a number of public workshops also early next year to talk about the proposal and the proposed rules, and then sometime later on we'll be working on the rule adoption and implementation. So that's my brief overview of the low carbon fuel standard. I'm happy to answer questions, and if I could just take 1 minute, Chair Cannon, to also mention just briefly some of the other activities we have going on with regard to climate change legislation. Also in House Bill 2186, we were directed to evaluate a proposal for truck efficiency and idling. We'll be working with the work group and bringing a report to the October interim committees on that. Senate Bill 38 expanded greenhouse gas reporting. We have another advisory committee that's working to develop recommendations for that rulemaking. For our low emission vehicle program, the federal government has now come out with a commitment to adopt greenhouse gas reductions for passenger vehicles and light-duty trucks modeled after the California regulations, and that is supposed to be adopted in March. So once that happens, then we'll be doing rules to conform our program to the federal program. And then finally, after March, the federal government is going to begin requiring states to permit greenhouse gas emission sources, and so we'll be beginning our evaluation of that issue, and that will be a major issue we'll be talking with you about during the 2011 session. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions either on the low carbon fuel standard or those other activities.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, Annie, and we'll see about members of the committee. as well. What this may not be sort of directly within your area of expertise, but what's the status of kind of Oregon with respect to the cellulosic fuels industry? So we know, I think we recognize that in order to meet that 10% reduction by 2020, we will need to transition towards a greater reliance on not just ethanol, but likely cellulosic ethanol. What activity has there been in Oregon to move that technology toward towards fruition?
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I'm not actually an expert on all those details, but I do know there are some exciting developments in Oregon. A company called Zeochem is moving ahead with advanced cellulosic ethanol, and I know others are as well. So there's definite movement. I would have to check with my colleagues at the Department of Energy to give you a more thorough answer.
Sure. How, and a separate question, how will... what sort of process will you use to address the land use issue, which is called out in the bill as part of the life cycle analysis that needs to apply to fuels? And it's been a controversial part, as other states, at least California, has attempted to take that on. How will our process treat land use?
Chair Cameron, members of the committee, our advisory committee hasn't discussed that issue yet, so I don't know what their recommendation will be, but just briefly for the benefit of the committee, that the issue is that as you convert, say, agricultural land or other lands into biofuels production, then there's an indirect impact on greenhouse gases, and you want to make sure that you don't increase emissions by, say, clearing forest land or moving agricultural production for food elsewhere and have that offset the greenhouse gas benefit from your biofuels. So California addressed that by calculating the indirect impacts of that those land use changes on biofuels, and essentially it goes into the calculation of the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions, and it shows that those types of fuels would have higher life cycle emissions than if you didn't consider the indirect land use effects, and so it makes them compete not as well against other biofuels, and causes, for example, cellulosic ethanol to be much better in comparison, because it doesn't have those same types of land use effects. It's made out of waste products. You're right, Representative Cannon, it's a controversial issue. The modeling to evaluate that is an inexact science, and it affects different stakeholder groups differently, and we expect it to be just as controversial in Oregon as it was in California. As I said, we haven't discussed it with the committee yet, so I don't really know how we're going to end up on that item.
Thank you, Andy.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Andy, thank you, Director, for this work. I, given the fact that we're focusing on jobs and the economic challenges our state faces, am I correct in assuming that the department will be taking into account, and I think you mentioned it earlier, the impact that this will have upon the economy of Oregon, and more to my district, the impact it might have in different parts of Oregon? And I'm just taking us back a few days to talking about the bio element of diesel fuel and the fact that it's going to cost my district as much as 20 to 40 cents a gallon more just because of our location adjacent to Idaho. So I just want to know if in your activities you're going to be taking into account the economic cost along with the environmental cost of not doing it, let's say, but of doing it. Are you doing that, and if so, how?
Representative.
Well, I'll just start out, Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz. Sort of absolutely the message was clear from the legislature that we have to really look hard at all the economic cost side of this low-carbon fuel standard. So we heard that message loud and clear, not only in the bill, but in terms of moving forward and engaging. So, Andy, you can maybe go to some of the detail.
Yeah, and I'll just add that that's a central part of the economic analysis that our contractor will be conducting, and it's an issue that will be a major point of discussion for our advisory committee. It's extremely important that we consider the jobs impacts and also the costs of transportation fuel and how that plays through the economy. So that's all a part of the economic analysis.
Maybe you can say a few words more about that EPA grant and how much it was for and who we're using to do the economic analysis.
Chair Cannon, the EPA grant came from a pool of funds that Congress set aside for energy analysis of environmental air quality impact analysis of energy projects. And each EPA region received a portion of those funds. And in Region 10, where we are, because Oregon and Washington are both evaluating and moving forward with the low carbon fuel standard, our colleagues in Idaho and Alaska graciously allowed all the funding in this year to go towards the low carbon fuel standard economic analysis. Excuse me. So we're doing the analysis together with Washington as an efficiency measure. As I think you know, 90% of our transportation fuel comes from refineries in Washington. So our analysis and their analysis will be very similar. There will be some differences, of course, but sharing this effort makes a lot of sense. And so the funds were split up between the two agencies. We have not yet hired our contractor. We're still finalizing the request for proposals, so I can't tell you who that will be.
Okay. Thank you. Jimmy, Representative Dixon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a little bit of a question on the grant from the EPA and how that fits into or what you freed up in your budget from the grant from EPA, since the budget included some item for this particular activity at the time we went out without knowing there would be a grant money coming.
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, if I understand your question correctly, we didn't receive any new funding to implement House Bill 2186, and so we were going to do our best to do the economic analysis with existing funds. Would not have been a very thorough analysis, and we were very concerned about whether we'd be able to provide the committee with adequate information. And so we pressed hard for EPA to provide us with the grant, and as a result, we're going to be able to do a much, much better job. And so I'm not sure if I exactly answered your question, though.
Yeah, I think you probably have answered it. One additional question, if I could. Memory has it that originally rail was given a free ride or something. I don't know exactly how to describe that, but wasn't going to be part of the consideration. But I did hear you say in your laundry list of names or groups that they were part of your work group. Could you help me with where rail is at the present time and what your plans are?
Yes, Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen. The bill doesn't say anything specific about rail, but interstate rail must be exempted because of interstate commerce issues and is exempted from California's program. The questions, as House Bill 2186 was being considered, had to do with intrastate rail. And so we are meeting with a work group of rail representatives in Oregon to figure out how to address that. In California, they did include intrastate rail locomotives that I believe the ones that spend 90% of their time within the state in the program. We haven't figured out yet whether that will happen in Oregon or not. We're talking with the rail folks to figure out the details. But whatever we do, we have to take into account the fact that, number one, my understanding is that rail engine manufacturers will not warrant an engine that uses biofuels, and so we can't require rail or end up with a situation where rail has to purchase biofuels or where the cost of their fuel would go up significantly because they have to avoid purchasing biofuels. And so those are the issues that we're discussing with the rail representatives, and I've committed to them that we're going to work out a solution that's acceptable for them. The main issue that we need to make sure as we look at specific users and issues about fuels with their in their types of engines is that we still achieve the emission reduction goals of the program and set up our exemptions in a way that don't interfere with that. So I think we'll be able to get there. I'm quite sure we'll be able to get there. We just haven't finished our discussions yet.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you for that. Appreciate you know the efforts. Well, you start talking about the carbon footprint, though the if somehow or another for the in-state rail we were to more or less force them out of the business because of the lack of guarantee on the engines, and also I think probably most of the engines that these companies would use are older engines which might be more vulnerable to biodiesel than some of the newer ones, and I don't know that, but I would kind of worry about it a little bit. The carbon footprint would just be increased as far as moving product if that particular transportation mode was somehow or another excluded because of our standards.
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, we're definitely very sensitive to those concerns. Also, just for your information, we're also hearing from barge lines and truckers who compete with rail, and we need to make sure the rule also has a level playing field. So all those issues have to be sorted through, and the committee will discuss them thoroughly.
Okay, great. Any further questions from the committee? Thanks for your hard work on this. Appreciate your willingness to make yourself available to me and I'm sure to other members of the committee for additional discussion between now and 2011 when we're likely to be, you know, in this setting again and hearing about your progress.
Yes, Chair Cannon, I would, and members of the committee, I'd also echo that. We're willing to come to interim committee meetings or any committee meetings at any time, or if any members would like to hear more about it or learn more about what we're doing, we're more than happy to accommodate that request.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Thank you. With that, we'll close the informational session and close the House Committee on Environment and Water. We are in our